And so today we continue our series on the Sermon on the Mount. According to Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, these teachings of Jesus take place at the top of a summit overlooking the beautiful Sea of Galilee, and the only people present are his chosen 12 disciples. Luke phrases it a little differently, but we'll talk about that later. So our series is based on two main sources, and they are The Secret According to Jesus, Living a Joyful Life by Ed Townley, Reverend Ed Townley, and the book The Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox. In these lessons, Jesus unveils to his disciples a new perspective, different from the law of Moses and different from any theology they had ever known, really revolutionary. Remember, the Ten Commandments, the cornerstone of the old law, are all concerned with actions, what we should do and not do. And all the rules that evolved from those commandments are also about outer acts and rituals. What to eat and not eat, how to behave and not behave on the Sabbath, during worship services, and even during festivals. Jesus tells us, though, that he has not come to destroy the law, but to fulfill it, to bring new understanding that God's law is not just about outward acts and rituals. Instead, the new law calls us up to a higher dimension of spiritual awareness. The new law that is God in expression operates when we are centered in an energy of love. So to contrast the old law to his new perspective, Jesus uses this little format, and we've talked about it before. It is, you have heard it said, but I say, bringing the law to a different level. So once again, let's join Jesus and his 12 disciples on that mountaintop as he continues teaching. He says next, you have heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery in his heart. So what is Jesus really saying here? Ed Townley writes, firm rules, such as the Ten Commandments, help us return to spiritual awareness by emphasizing an important aspect of our human condition, and that is that actions have consequences. Negative actions like murder, deceit, and adultery have negative consequences because when we're involved in such acts, like Cain after he murdered his brother Abel, we too are fugitives and wanderers on the earth, having lost sight of our spiritual identity. And that's what makes them so negative. So notice, Jesus does not deny that actions have consequences. He does not come to abolish the law. However, he leads us to that new dimension of our relationship with God, helping us understand that thoughts have power and consequence, and spiritual damage is done when we choose to embrace and hold negative energy in our minds. Now, thankfully, that does not mean that we're held hostage by every single thought that enters our heads. Thank goodness, right? We have a choice. Negative thoughts, really, like lust, can be a part of our human experience, but we do not have to allow them to take root and multiply. We can gently brush them away without damage, or we can allow them to take up permanent residence in our minds, dwell on them, and take on their negative energy. And in that case, we reap negative consequences whether or not we even engage in the outer acts. Now, some of you will remember, I don't know if you'll admit remembering, but some of you will remember, in 1976, presidential candidate Jimmy Carter caused quite a stir in an interview with Playboy magazine. I bet you never thought I would be quoting that source, did you? But anyway. So discussing the role of religion in his life, Jimmy Carter said, I have looked on a lot of women with lust. I've committed adultery in my heart many times. Now that comment almost lost him the presidency. And I'm guessing it didn't set too well with Rosalind either. Time magazine included this among the top 10 unfortunate political one-liners of all time. But few of us remember Jimmy Carter's next words. They were, "This is something that God recognizes I do, and God forgives me for it." So obviously, Jimmy Carter was taking Jesus' words literally. Now, in the revealing word, Charles Fillmore, our Uni co-founder, says, metaphysically, adultery has a different meaning. It has to do with errors that have their existence in thoughts that have been under the have not been under the dominion of the spiritual I am. So they're really error thoughts. And he says specifically the act of adultery is an expression of thoughts of lack, limitation, and separation. So just think about that for a moment. That when we're tempted to engage in that behavior, we really and truly are thinking of ourselves finding love in somebody else, trying to replace the love that we feel we're lacking. And when we hold adulterous thoughts in mind even, we are seeing the other as separate. Jesus is telling us that as long as we view any other human being as separate or less than, we are not in the kingdom of heaven. The presence of God is about oneness, the awareness that we're all interconnected because we're all individualized expressions of the same God. And remember in the Beatitudes, where Jesus talks about the states of being, he says, "Blessed are they who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be satisfied." And I know many of you know metaphysically righteousness means what? Right thinking, absolutely. And so, Ed Townley writes, this spiritual truth forms the basis for Jesus' new perspective. Behavior is important, but true righteousness, right thinking, requires more. It requires a consciousness of our oneness with God from which only right action flows. Now, Jesus is just warming up. Next, he says, if your eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. If your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Wow. Wow. This teaching is really difficult to understand when viewed from the outer perspective. And the point is, Jesus is not talking about outer perspective. He is talking about inner perspective. And with every thought, we have to realize, first of all, that heaven and hell are states of consciousness. They are not physical places, they are states of consciousness. And with every single thought, we are choosing one or the other. Reverend Townley notes, we recognize the kingdom of heaven as described by Jesus as a conscious oneness with God. That's what heaven is, our feeling always of being completely connected and united with the divine. And we create this kingdom on earth as we allow that power of God to express through our thoughts and take form in the outer world. The kingdom of hell is the exact opposite. It is that state of mind where we believe ourselves to be separate from God, and therefore we create our life experiences not only from separation, but from fear and limitation. In truth, there is no power opposite to God. We all know that the divine mind, God, spirit, whatever we want to call this perfect divine energy, is omnipotence, omniscience, and omnipresence. Townley says, the kingdom of hell is an illusion, but through our choices, we can make it a painful illusion indeed. So it all comes down to where we're turning. Are we turning to this indwelling I am energy of God, or are we turning elsewhere? Our souls are pivotal. They can choose faith or fear, love or judgment, peace or discord. Townley says, and this is very interesting, there are no neutral choices. No Switzerland here. No neutral choices. In every moment, we either choose heaven or we choose hell. Now, in this teaching, Jesus uses some striking images, doesn't he? Tearing out an eye and cutting off a hand. I'm sure that captured the disciples' attention, should they have fallen asleep, and that's probably the point. He's trying to be really striking, but certainly he is not advocating self-mutilation here. We know that. That's not the Jesus we know. Instead, he reminds his disciples and us of the first commandment of the old law, which is, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. The seminal law. Now, of course, at the time Jesus gave this teaching, most of the people in the whole Mediterranean were pagan, and they worshiped many gods. So this was his way of saying there is one presence and one power. However, well over 2,000 years later, when we're sitting here not worshiping many gods, what is this message for us today? And I think the message is, what other gods do we worship? Gods of career priorities, I've been there. Gods of romantic involvement, wealth, fame, status. Now, don't misunderstand, all these can be blessings of the human experience. And it's certainly God's pleasure to give us the kingdom. But if we make them more important than our relationship with the divine, with our spiritual purpose, we are creating false gods and moving toward that kingdom of hell. Jesus is saying nothing in this physical realm, nothing is more important than our relationship with the divine. No matter how cherished and important something may seem, if it pulls our focus away from oneness, it will poison our mind. So the right eye represents inner spiritual perception and subsequent actions. If we see others as separate, we need to pluck that out of our perception. The right hand represents the hand of God. You know the saying, the right hand of God. And that really stands for omnipresence. So Jesus' words, if your right hand offends you, could refer to practices that are not compatible with the practice of God. And he may have been referring to some of the practices of the early Hebrews, all of the rituals. And he is saying, cut anything not aligned with God out of your life. Cut out any thought or act that is incompatible with divine love flowing through us. In order to create that kingdom on earth, we move our focus from the false gods and practices of this world to the one presence and power within. So fasten your seatbelts. Jesus is on a roll at this point of the Sermon on the Mount. Next he says, it is also said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, makes her the victim of adultery. And anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Now, Ed Townley says, for obvious reasons, this is probably the least quoted of all the teachings of Jesus. At least in Protestant churches, right? At least. If we were to remove from our churches all those who are divorced and or remarried, few adults would be left in the pews or in the pulpit. And that's true. More than one Bible scholar believes these words were never uttered by Jesus. And that it's possible. Ed Townley says he thinks it is possible that they were never uttered by Jesus, but added by the early church. However, we realize that every time Jesus spoke, he spoke on multi-levels of meaning. It was very multi-dimensional. And so if he did deliver this teaching, there must be a spiritual lesson in it. And in order to gain some understanding about what that lesson might be, first let's remember the historical context. That in the Middle East, in the time of Jesus, women were considered little more than personal property. It was not uncommon for men to dissolve marriage on very slight grounds, and they could do so by standing up and declaring, I divorce you 3 times. And that was it. That was all that was required by Jesus' day. I guess that did save legal fees, come to think of it. However, the woman had little recourse, almost no recourse. And that's why Jesus says, I believe, there must at least be a certificate of divorce. Also, total fidelity was demanded of the wife in marriage. Absolutely. If she were caught in adultery, the penalty according to Mosaic law was death by stoning. We looked at a story not too long ago where the Pharisees bring a woman to Jesus and say, she's committed adultery, do we stone her? And he said, let those of you who are without sin cast the first stone. So the point is, there was no such rule for men. Surprise, surprise, right? Also, divorced women were often disowned by their very own families and forced into begging, prostitution, starvation, and often death. Certainly, Jesus was dedicated to changing the social structure and improving the status of women. He taught throughout his ministry higher spiritual principles to men and women alike, so that anyone who did the work to awaken would be welcome in the kingdom of heaven. And we've already heard Jesus teach that thoughts have as much, if not more, power than actions. So Ed Townley says Jesus may be drawing a distinction here between marriage laws that were created by man and spiritual laws based on loving one another. In an incident reported in Mark, the Pharisees try to test Jesus, and they ask him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? Jesus, always the excellent teacher, follows that question with another. And he asks them, what did Moses command you? They respond, Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of divorce and send her away. Then Jesus makes the compelling statement, that was because your hearts were hard that Moses wrote you this law. And he concludes with a phrase that's part of our Unity wedding ceremony in a little different form. It is, therefore, what God has joined together, let no person separate. I usually say let no person or situation separate, but it's the same idea. So Ed Townley writes, this means if, and this is kind of a different perspective, I think. He says, this means if a union is truly of God, if the commitment is wholeheartedly spiritual, nothing we can ever do on the mortal plane could ever destroy it. But clearly, he says, not every marriage is joined together by God. Many are entered into for a variety of human reasons and personal needs, and they never were spiritual unions in the first place. Townley says, if that's the case, to remain in a relationship bound by human laws may be damaging to the spiritual paths and purposes of both parties involved. As Jesus said, what God has joined together is what matters. So I think our daily word is a perfect fit to today's lesson, the word about guidance. I believe it's saying in any human conflict, including a situation about whether we leave a spouse, we prayerfully turn to the loving guidance of divine mind within, and we will be led to perfect wisdom and clarity about what the divine solution is and what are the next steps. This is what Emmett Fox calls a spiritual solution, like the golden key. Emmett Fox suggests, that one lesson we can take away from Jesus' teachings about divorce is that impulsively running away from our problems is not the answer. He writes, just as in running from one business partner to another, from one job to another, one home to another, without having brought a change in our consciousness, we find ourselves repeating the old conditions in a slightly different form. So as a rule, people who divorce freely, trying one marriage after another, are apt to end up more dissatisfied than they began. And I think that's certainly true. I have a really good friend who lives out of state, and a former colleague, who recently said to me on the phone, looking back, I realize I married the same type of man 3 times and it didn't work any of the 3 times, which is true. We sometimes just keep repeating the error, don't we? So Statistics tell us today, unlike in Jesus' time, that over 50% of marriages end in divorce or permanent separation, and the divorce rate for subsequent marriages is even higher. So obviously, casual, impulsive divorce can be harmful to our spiritual growth. Townley writes, "A true spiritual commitment of any kind cannot be dismissed easily when it becomes uncomfortable. However, no one could possibly believe that Jesus is recommending staying in a toxic, abusive, emotionally harmful marriage. The power of God cannot bind anyone or anything to negativity. God is love, and where love is absent, there cannot be a sacred union." So in all three of the teachings we looked at today, I think they all have similar themes. When we know and live from the presence of God within, we understand that not just our actions, but also our words and thoughts need to be creative expressions of the divine. Living in oneness, we behold the Christ in ourselves and all humankind, as in moment by moment we choose the kingdom of heaven. So we'll continue exploring the Sermon on the Mount in the weeks ahead, and not all of Jesus' teachings are quite as heavy as they were today, so stay tuned. But for now, let's join together in knowing that when we are in Christ's consciousness, the universe holds nothing back. We are on this earth to be God in expression, and we allow no person or situation to interfere with our spiritual purpose. We knowingly and lovingly create the kingdom, one thought, one choice, one commitment at a time, and so it is. So let's take some time now to just affirm the great truth about our God. And for those of you who are here for the first time, this affirmation is printed in your bulletin. It's being said in Unity churches really all over the world this morning. There is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.